This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. And leading off, first of all, we'll say a few comments about the tragedy emerging in Japan. Not only did we have a devastating 8.9 earthquake, the fifth largest in world history since we've been tracking earthquakes around 1900, not only did we have a tsunami that inundated over 1,000 miles of real estate, causing enormous property destruction and death, but we also have an ongoing nuclear nightmare, a partial meltdown, in fact, more than one in Japan, which is heavily dependent upon nuclear energy. And then later on in the program, we'll bring two special guests. We'll talk about the other consequences of our dependence on oil. And our first special guest will be Joseph Rahm, who will talk about global warming, another consequence of the burning of fossil fuels. And then we're going to bring on Travis Bradford, who'll talk about, well, an optimistic note, solar power, a solar revolution that may one day make us independent of oil and nuclear energy. But first, let me say a few things about the ongoing tragedy in Japan, which is changing day by day, hour by hour. As we mentioned before, an 8.9 earthquake ripped right through the ocean floor, creating a tsunami over a distance of 250 miles. The tsunami then spread over the pond called the Pacific Ocean, inundating not only huge parts of northern Japan, but also even parts of the United States of America on the west coast. However, the real devastation is concentrated in the northern provinces, specifically with regards to the nuclear power plants. At least four nuclear power plants were badly damaged by the initial earthquake, and Units 1 and Units 3 of Fukushima Daiichi 1 are particularly important because they sustained perhaps the largest amount of damage, leading to a partial meltdown. So let me explain what is a meltdown and what does it mean. First of all, nuclear power, in some sense, is a rather expensive way to boil water. You have a very hot core of uranium, usually about 12 feet tall, weighing about 100 tons, containing uranium dioxide. It has to be cooled down with water at all times. When the water is heated up, the water is circulated, goes through a heat exchanger into a turbine, and then generates electricity. So the core basically generates boiling water to spin a turbine to create electricity. However, the cooling water also serves to cool down the core. The core has to be constantly cooled or it will melt of its own. The core is very hot, about 3,400 degrees Fahrenheit. However, if you uncover the core and the core no longer has any cooling whatsoever, very rapidly temperatures rise to about 5,000 degrees. And at that point, uranium dioxide begins to melt. And this is the meltdown. Now, the process of meltdown actually takes several hours. It doesn't happen all at once. So here are the following steps. First of all, water has to drop below the top of the core, exposing the uranium rods. That's step number one. Step number two is when the core is fully exposed and begins to rise to 5,000 degrees. It takes about 30 minutes to several hours for it to completely melt. And at Three Mile Island, for example, about 80% of the core was uncovered for about an hour, and it began to melt. In fact, 90% core damage was suffered at Three Mile Island. So that's step two, core meltdown, when the core begins to melt. Step three is when you have an explosion. Now, up to now, the radiation is contained. The melted fuel is contained in what is called the vessel. The vessel looks like a gigantic aspirin capsule, and it contains the uranium dioxide rods. It's very thick, sometimes 6 to 8 inches thick. However, surrounding the vessel, there's the containment structure. That's the dome that you sometimes see in photographs. Sometimes it's cubical, sometimes it looks like a gigantic dome. However, the point is that you have two layers, the vessel, which contains the rods, and the containment structure, which actually contains the entire thing. Well, in the third stage, you get an explosion. Several mechanisms are possible. One is that hydrogen gas is emitted by a chemical reaction at very hot temperatures. The hydrogen gas can detonate. That's what happened at Three Mile Island, in fact, though the reactor held. And it also happened at Fukushima, but it blew the containment structure apart. So it was a hydrogen steam gas explosion that blew the containment structure at Fukushima. Now, another possibility is a steam explosion where hot metal comes in contact with cold cooling water that has spilled onto the floor. Take a very hot frying pan and put hot oil on it, and then put a drop of water on the hot oil. You probably know that you get a small mini explosion because the oil is deceptively hot. Even though it doesn't look hot, it's really hot, and the water droplet instantly turns into steam. Well, that's a mini steam explosion. So when the hot core touches cold water, you get a steam explosion. And a combination of these things is also possible. The point is that you can rupture the vessel, blow the containment structure apart, and then you have a Chernobyl-type accident. In fact, at Chernobyl, about 25% of the core was pulverized and shot into space. When the plume starts to rise, containing all these fission products, then the winds blow the plume downwind, and then you get a pencil-thin cylinder of very hot gas and dust coming out of the reactor. As the winds blow, it's sort of like a lighthouse. The light coming from a lighthouse, it sways with the wind. That's what happens when the radiation comes out. Now, in Japan, they had an evacuation radius of 2 miles. That wasn't enough. They set it to 6 miles, then up to 12 miles. In the United States, the evacuation zone is out to 10 miles from a nuclear power plant. But if the radiation is collimated, it may not disperse that much. And I personally think you have to go out 20 to 50 miles before radiation levels really begin to drop. Now, what's the state of the reactor right now? First of all, when the initial earthquake took place, it was a 1-2 punch. First, the lights went out. Off-site power was lost at that reactor. Well, no problem. Reactors are designed to operate even if you lose off-site power because they're backup systems. And the backup systems, in turn, operate the pumps and the fail-safe device. Well, this is where it deviated from the script. Then the tsunami hit. All of a sudden, we had this wall of water hit the reactor. The reactors are very close to the ocean because they use ocean water as a coolant. They have to be close to the ocean. And this wall of water knocked out the backup systems. So the system was basically dead in the water. It lost all power, off-site power, on-site power, all power was lost. That means all the fail-safe systems were also lost. Well, water levels began to drop. The reactor got hotter and hotter, pressure built up, and they had to vent the pressure. They vented the reactor, but hydrogen gas escaped, and hydrogen gas then ignited with oxygen, and it blew the top off the reactor. And then the operators, realizing, oh my God, the pumps are out, the containment structure is blown off, water levels are dropping, we're talking full-scale meltdown at that point. And then they did something highly unorthodox, and that is they let in seawater from the Pacific right into the core. Now, this is not mentioned in engineering books. This is a science experiment. They're literally making it up as they go along. This has never, ever been done before in the history of nuclear power. In some sense, the Japanese people are guinea pigs to this horrendous accident. Well, so far, so good. As long as seawater covers the core, then it's relatively calm and stable. But there's also Unit 3 to worry about. Unit 3 also has problems. In fact, 3 reactors were badly affected by the accident. And at Unit 3, apparently, water levels dropped. According to some reports, the entire core, about 90% of the core, was in fact exposed to the air without any cooling water whatsoever. Well, the operators also diverted seawater into Unit 3, but apparently there's a leak in the bottom, and it leaked right out again. So the plant operators are desperately trying to keep the core covered, even though every once in a while the core is uncovered because there's simply not enough seawater to keep it covered. So, by analogy, think of a car that has suddenly gone into runaway mode. Well, what do?
you hit the brakes. Well, the brakes don't work. That's the fail-safe system, because the tsunami wiped out all the electricity in the fail-safe systems. So the brakes don't work. Well, then your car begins to heat up, and then the radiator blows its top, and all of a sudden you have all that steam coming out of the radiator. And then you realize, oh my God, next could be a fuel explosion when the gasoline catches on fire, and then you're dead meat. What do you do at that point? Well, here you are in a runaway car with no brakes, with a radiator that's blown, and your gas tank could explode. What do? Well, you look for the nearest river, and you ditch the car in the river. Well, that's apparently what the plant operators have decided to do. This is a one-way street. Once you put raw seawater into a nuclear power plant, the nuclear power plant cannot be reclaimed. There's corrosion coming from the salt, plus you have all the contaminants inside the seawater. This is not recommended in the book. This is a last-ditch effort. A last-ditch effort because they're basically throwing everything at that core, including the kitchen sink, to keep it covered with water. That's the fundamental problem, because once the core is uncovered, it starts to heat up, and once it reaches 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, it starts to melt, and then an explosion could rip the reactor apart. And then we have to realize that this accident here is second only to Chernobyl. Now, remember that there are three layers you have to think about. First is the core itself, which is like a very hot box, about 12 feet tall. Surrounding the core, there's a pill that looks like a vessel, looks like an aspirin pill, and it is quite thick, made out of solid reactor steel. Then surrounding that is the dome, or the containment structure, or the rectangular structure. So there are three layers there. At Chernobyl, all three were breached. The core melted, a steam hydrogen explosion took place, blew the vessel and blew the top right off the reactor. At Three Mile Island, the core melted. In fact, it was a 90% core melt at Three Mile Island, but the workers were able to flood the core in time, so you didn't have a full-scale meltdown. That is, the reactor did not undergo an explosion. So at Three Mile Island, the vessel was intact, and the containment structure was intact. Well, at the Fukushima reactor, the containment structure was blown apart by a hydrogen gas explosion, and we're keeping our fingers crossed as to the state of the core itself. But like I mentioned, the situation changes hour by hour. Almost any time you hear a report about the state of the reactor is already obsolete, because that's how fast nuclear power plant accidents take place. We should also point out that don't expect a cloud to sail over your house in the United States. So don't expect a cloud of radioactive dust from Japan to sail over your house at all. However, in the States, we have to make a much bigger decision, and that is whether to go nuclear at all. This is a Faustian bargain. Faust was the mythical figure who sold his soul to the devil for unlimited power. And in an age of global warming, in an age where we recognize our dependency on Middle Eastern oil and the stability it brings, some people find nuclear very attractive. But on the other hand, is it really a deal with the devil? Now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. He's Dr. Joseph Rom. He's the founder of the Center for Energy and Climate Solutions. He's also been a former acting assistant secretary at the Department of Energy. And he's the author of a, well, rather scary book. It's called Hell and High Water and What We Should Do About It. It's a book about global warming that'll scare the pants off you. He uses the most authoritative, the best computer projections to look into the world of 2020, 2050, and 2100, and he finds out that, well, yes, many cities of the United States are going to be underwater, the coastline of America will be unrecognizable,
And of course, this means trillions of dollars in damages, not to mention hundreds of millions of peoples whose lands will be submerged underwater. This also means food famines. It also means food riots. It also means a collapse of the old civilizations as we knew them. So once again, our special guest today is Dr. Joseph Rahm, and the title of his disturbing book is Hell and High Water. The first question for you, Dr. Rahm, is how did you, as a student, get interested in the whole question of global warming?
Sure. Well, I think the answer to that question is that about 1990, I talked to a lot of the top experts in energy security and in national security and asked them what were the emerging problems facing the planet. And a surprising number of them said that it was global warming. And so that's sort of when I realized I wanted to understand the subject more. And I started working with Amory Lovins on energy efficiency matters and studying up on global warming. And ultimately, I ended up at the Department of Energy working on greenhouse gas mitigation technologies and helping push energy efficiency and renewable energy.
Okay. Well, just a few weeks ago, the United Nations issued its mammoth Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, authored by 600 scientists, peer-reviewed by 600 more scientists, so at least 1,200 scientists were involved in the latest Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Summarize for us a little bit what the report said.
Well, the report, which is the consensus of the top scientists in the world, basically said that it is very likely that the warming that we've seen in the past 50 years is due to human emissions of heat-trapping greenhouse gases. And that is a pretty strong statement that, you know, I think everyone understands that the weather is changing. You know, we in Washington, D.C., we had the cherry blossoms bloom in January. So the question that the global warming deniers, the people who've been trying to block action on climate change, have been saying is, well, okay, the climate is changing, but humans aren't the cause. So this report lays that to rest. Humans are the cause. And what's more, in the future, we can expect 3 to 7 degrees Fahrenheit warming this century, rising sea levels, more intense hurricanes, droughts, wildfires, and the like. So it's a pretty alarming picture.
Okay, well, I just got back from speaking in Switzerland, and there we have this $130 billion tourist industry over wintertime, which might collapse because the snows only exist at the very tops of the Alps. And so summarize a little bit what's happening with the glaciers of the Earth, what's happening with the North Polar region and the South Polar region.
Well, as the planet warms, it warms even more at the poles. And you get this amplifying effect where you're replacing white snow or white ice with either blue ocean or dark land. So instead of reflecting more light, you get more absorption of heat and light. So the poles get warmer and warmer, and we've seen a dramatic decrease, about 25% in the extent of the Arctic pole sea ice, and we've been seeing rapid melting of the glaciers. Those include the inland glaciers, but more importantly, Greenland and Antarctica have been losing ice rapidly at their edges and starting to cause sea levels to rise faster than had been previously predicted.
And isn't it true that some point in the near future, the North Polar region may be totally ice-free during summertime, which would then change the whole climate of the North Polar region?
Absolutely. I think there's now a consensus that it's happening so fast that it might well happen in the lifetime of the listeners to your show. And that is quite alarming because the Arctic hasn't been ice-free for at least 1 million years. And as you say, it would change the climate dramatically.
And going back in time, we've had scientists who've analyzed ice cores, that is, drilling into the ice and extracting atmospheric conditions that existed hundreds of thousands of years ago. So how does the current rise in temperature within the last 50 years compare to the weather going back hundreds of thousands of years?
Well, we are getting close. We're about 2 degrees Fahrenheit away from the warmest that we were in the past few hundred thousand years. And if we go back to just 125,000 years ago, 2 degrees Fahrenheit warmer, sea levels were about 15 feet higher. There wasn't much ice in Greenland. So that would be a catastrophe when you consider that just 3 feet of sea level rise would cause 100 million environmental refugees around the planet.
Okay, now one thing your book does in very graphic detail, I thought, was to estimate what's going to happen in the next 20, 50, and 100 years if this continues unabated. And in your book, you talk about, first of all, the state of Florida. Tell us a little bit about what Florida is going to look like in 2100 if these conditions continue unabated.
Well, indeed, and I titled the book Hell and High Water because the consequences, I think, are fairly dire. And the high water part of this is that as the seas rise, the lowest lying areas in this country get flooded. And if anyone who's ever traveled to South Florida or the Keys knows, the entire bottom 100 miles of Florida are extremely shallow. And I think it's rather likely on our current path that by the 2100 and possibly by 2050, we will have flooded most of that area and had to abandon it in some sense back to nature.
And let me just read to you a few sentences from your book. You say that in this particular scenario, by 2100, some 400 million people worldwide will be exposed to the rising seas. And then talking about Florida, you write, in this country, one quarter of Florida will be submerged, and one third would be underwater when sea levels rise, hit 7.6 meters, or about 25 feet. So in other words, what you're talking about is redrawing the shape of the United States of America, aren't you?
Oh, I think that that is inevitable, and I think, you know, it's not that likely that we would see 7.6 meters this century, but I think it is very likely that we would know, even within 20 years, that we had kind of waited too long to stop this inexorable sea level rise. And at that point, people would have to decide which major cities along the coast we were going to save. And I think your listeners can appreciate, we saw with Hurricane Katrina that if a city has a large portion of its land under sea level, it's very hard to protect it from a major hurricane. So once South Florida is, you know, below sea level, people can put up levees if they want. But, you know, this is the dead center spot for where hurricanes hit. And, you know, the likelihood that we could, you know, save the Florida, and this is the same is true as Louisiana up to Baton Rouge and large parts of North Carolina and Delaware and Texas, would be flooded. Yes, the map would be redrawn, and we'd probably abandon the smaller coastal cities and try, like the Dickens, to protect, you know, Miami and Houston and New York.
And let me read again from your book. Louisiana, as you pointed out, would be in the same capsized boat flooded up to Baton Rouge. In Texas, Galveston, Corpus Christi, Beaumont, and Port Arthur would be submerged. Houston would be seriously at risk and difficult to protect from a combination of rising sea levels and super hurricanes. Savannah, Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina, Virginia's major coastal areas, one-fourth of Delaware, most land along Chesapeake Bay, and huge sections of such cities as Washington, D.C., New York, and Boston would be flooded. So tell us a little bit about New York City. I'm right here in New York City. I was watching Fox News a few months ago, and they talked about the possibility of maybe New York City being flooded. And they said, well, we'll just build dikes around Manhattan anyway. So what are your thoughts? What is New York City and Boston and Washington going to look like if sea levels continue to rise?
Well, I think that New York City, as the Earth gets warmer, the ocean gets warmer, we'll see hurricanes extend their reach further and further, and it's certainly not unprecedented for New York City to be hit by a hurricane. And I think it's true that we could put levees around the city. I think that we would have to put levees around the city. But, you know, we may be ending up in a situation where in 50 years sea levels are rising 3 inches a decade and maybe and accelerating, so that it becomes progressively, I think people have to understand, we're not talking about seas rising just like 3 feet and stopping. That would be easy to prepare for. People should understand that on the path that we are on today, we will warm 5 or 6 degrees Fahrenheit by the end of the century. That would take us to a temperature the Earth hasn't seen for several million years, when sea levels were 80 feet higher. Now, the 80 feet doesn't happen overnight, but it can happen over a period of many, many decades, and it just gets progressively harder and harder to protect your cities. So, yes, I think in the near term, you would put levees around New York, you'd put levees around Boston where you could, but, you know, you can't protect your entire coastline from sea levels that are 20 feet higher or 40 feet higher or 80 feet higher. It just becomes absurd.
In the past, New York City has been hit by nor'easters and hurricanes, which have dumped so much water into the subway system that it basically paralyzed the New York subway system. Thank God it was only momentarily. However, I guess it's a preview of what could happen if we have storm surges, in which case subway systems would be totally ground to a halt, right? Paralyzing the whole city.
Well, that's what the and I think the Weather Channel even had a show on what happens if just a Category 3 hurricane were to come up, come up directly towards Manhattan and push an immense storm surge. My brother, you asked how I got into climate change. The reason I wrote this book is because my brother lost his home in Hurricane Katrina. He was a mile inland, and they had 22 feet of water in their house. And I wanted to advise him as to whether or not to rebuild. So I talked to a lot of the top hurricane experts and climate experts, and that's what sort of led me to get very alarmed and write this particular book, because I've spent most of my life on the solution side of the problem. As you say, it's very, very hard to protect a major metropolis from huge storm surge associated with a hurricane.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest has been Dr. Joseph Rahm, author of a disturbing new book called Hell and High Water. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration, when we bring on Travis Bradford, author of the book Solar Revolution, who will lay out a blueprint as to what to do about it. Once again, it's the Solar Revolution in the second half of Exploration. So stay tuned for the next segment of Exploration. Welcome. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we brought on Dr. Joseph Rahm, author of the book Hell and High Water, talking about some of the maximum consequences of global warming.
And in the second half of Exploration, we're going to talk about what are we going to do about it. Our special guest is Travis Bradford, author of The Solar Revolution. And he believes that solar power could be the cure for some of the world's ills. You know, recently we had the anniversary of Katrina, and thinking about that horrible disaster in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm reminded of, well, what scientists believe could happen to the planet Earth if global warming takes over. What happens when governments begin to collapse? What happens when food riots erupt because growing areas turn into dust bowls? What happens when mass migrations take place, perhaps hundreds of millions of refugees pouring over borders? And according to one Pentagon study, the solution to that problem is to use nuclear weapons. So we may even see the use of nuclear weapons as nations disintegrate. So once again, our special guest in the second half of Exploration is Travis Bradford, author of the book Solar Revolution. And I would like to introduce our very special guest for today. You know, everybody complains about the weather, but no one does anything about it, said Mark Twain. Well, here's somebody who wants to do something about it and solve the energy crisis to boot. He's Travis Bradford, author of the new book, Solar Revolution, The Economic Transformation of the Global Energy Industry. He's a Harvard MBA with business experience. He's the founder of the Prometheus Institute for Sustainable Development, and he believes that the solar revolution is inevitable. Given the soaring price of fossil fuels, given the fact that one day we will run out of them, and given the decreasing costs of solar power, it's inevitable, he claims, that we're going to see a solar revolution. But will this revolution be bloody? Will this revolution require enormous disruptions in our lifestyle? Perhaps even raising the prospect of a collapse of the atmosphere unless we can reverse these trends in time. That's not clear at all. However, Solar Revolution makes the claim that we are within striking distance. We are within striking distance of making solar competitive with fossil fuel technology. And here is an economist and businessman who has the facts and figures to back it up. Once again, our guest today is Travis Bradford, author of the new book, Solar Revolution, The Economic Transformation of the Global Energy Industry. The first question for you is, how did you personally get interested in solar energy?
My personal interest in solar really comes from my background as a mergers and acquisitions and buyout professional in New York, and further as an investor as a private equity and a hedge fund. And I really began to think about the way that the energy infrastructure was unfolding and where that was going to create economic opportunities. I really didn't come at the solar energy industry from the environmental side, but really more from the business and economic side. And in my research, came up with some interesting conclusions about its potential that I don't think are widely appreciated yet.
Okay, well, let's talk about the present situation with regards to fossil fuels. First, oil. Give us your prognosis about how oil consumption will grow or decrease over the next 10, 20 years.
Well, the consumption in oil has been pretty steadily growing over a long period of time. And the available supplies have also been growing, but a lot of people talk about the inevitable peak in production of oil. The U.S. oil production has leveled off in the early 70s, and it's been dropping ever since, even despite our best efforts at bringing more oil out of our available reservoirs. So with consumption continuing to rise and not a lot of plans in place to use it more efficiently, CAFE standards, the fuel economy standards have not been increasing in the United States. We're really getting to a point where consumption and the available supplies are getting stretched, prices have risen, and they will probably rise further, though a lot of my ideas about where the energy industry is going don't necessarily presume that energy prices will rise above today's level.
Well, we've had some guests on exploration, including the provost of Caltech, who mentioned that there is something called Hubbard's Peak, which is this bell-shaped curve of energy supplies, and we're at the top of it, and we can only go downhill, in which case there could be massive disruption in the world economy. But what are your thoughts?
Well, the science is increasingly well understood. Hubbard's Peak has been understood since Hubbard initially was proved right in the United States and North America in the early 70s. A number of countries have passed their Hubbard's Peak, and now the remaining supplies are increasingly concentrated in regions of the world that are thought of as less stable or secure. The problem is, all on top of the Hubbard's Peak issue, though, is that the entire supply infrastructure is stretched thin. There's not a lot of spare pumping capacity, even in the Middle East, where historically they were able to act as a pressure valve for world demand. And the process of getting the oil from where it's pumped through shipping, refining, and delivery to where it's needed has been stretched very thin in the last 5 years, and that's causing serious systemic problems that are as much a risk as running out of the fuel supplies themselves.
Some people have stated that we would have to find a new Middle East every 10 years in order to maintain our current consumption, and especially with China and India beginning to enter the world oil market in a big way. Well, that's not going to happen, right? We're not going to find another Middle East every 10 years. But what are your thoughts?
Well, that's, I believe, your statement to be true. And what it will mean is that inevitably we're either going to have to use oil supplies more efficiently and effectively, or prices are going to rise. And in my estimation, both of those will have to occur. But it makes it for a very powerful economic opportunity for the rising portfolio of alternatives.
And what about coal? The United States apparently has enough coal to last for 500 years, according to some estimates. But what about the environmental costs and the costs of converting liquefying coal? What about the dangers and promise of coal?
Yes, the number that you stated, I think, is at the high end of the range of estimates. Certainly when you imagine that we're going to continue to increase our consumption of coal, the rate of depletion increases, and I've seen estimates that are in the in the decades range, not the centuries range, of the availability of coal to meet growing energy demand. The liquefaction process, turning coal into liquid fuels for transportation, is well understood process, but the environmental impacts, as you alluded to, are devastating unless we can figure out a way to capture and sequester the carbon. And there's lots of talk about that, but there's not a lot of good business models, and there isn't really the global focus that would need to exist in order to feel confident that that's actually going to be done. What my concern is that we'll continue to use coal out of economic necessity, and we will forget that there are these environmental impacts unless there's a major sea change in sort of global political will.
Okay, now let's get to the heart of your book, Solar Revolution, the Economic Transformation of the Global Energy Industry. And let's talk about the economics. If you talk to the average homeowner, they would say that, well, yeah, solar is great, but only Hollywood millionaires who can afford it have these beautiful solar homes, and who can afford that? So what do you say to people who say that solar is a luxury of the Hollywood elite?
Well, certainly people with the available capital and time and resources have the luxury of being able to adopt systems for their homes. But that's I think, a function in many cases of the ones that have been publicized, not indicative of the way the industry is actually unfolding. The solar has taken off outside of the United States more than it has in the United States. Japan, Germany have been world leaders due to good public policy programs and local consumer demand for solar technologies, and those certainly aren't on showcase homes. They're mainstream homes and farms and businesses. In the United States, the market has actually developed on the commercial side, meaning on businesses or warehouse facilities, larger commercial systems, wineries have been early adopters of solar energy. And so the commercial market really is taking off a lot more than the residential market has. Just in the last year, the federal government instituted its first solar energy tax credit for systems in 25 years, and California instituted what's known as their Million Solar Roofs Initiative, funding $3.35 billion for new small, medium-sized systems in the state of California, making it a world leader in deploying solar technology. So I'm not sure that the technology is going pet projects, but it really is a mainstream technology at this point.
Okay, let's talk about cost per kilowatt hour. In your book, you have a chart going over the different efficiencies that we have with regards to different energies and cost. For coal, you have it at roughly 5 cents per kilowatt hour. For hydropower, even nuclear, we're talking about 5 to maybe 10 cents per kilowatt hour. But solar, you have it here between 15 and 25 cents per kilowatt hour. So explain to us now the economics for the homeowner.
Well, that's the for starters, homeowners can't generate coal-based power at those rates. The rates that you're looking at are utility-scale power, and there's still the cost. Once a utility has generated that power, there's still a cost to get the electricity from where it's generated to where it's needed. And in fact, that's a very large part of what consumers see in their end utility bills. It can be as much as half or more of the total cost of electricity. So what's happening in the solar industry is that it's bifurcating so that there is utility scale solar power that's being developed. 2.5 gigawatts of new capacity have been provincially announced in the last year for centralized concentrating solar plants that can actually deliver electricity, you know, somewhere between 9 and 15 cents a kilowatt hour. And the economics there are that it doesn't compete with coal or nuclear, which provide nice steady baseload power, but it actually provides the daytime peak and intermediate load power, which is the most expensive power for utilities to generate. So when you compare solar at the utility level to the to the energy and electricity that it replaces, it is much more cost effective than people think. But from the other part of the bifurcation is that at the home, it's not the correct comparison to look at the cost of solar at 15 to 25 cents a kilowatt hour on the home versus what it costs the utilities to generate electricity. What you should be comparing it against is the cost of the electricity that the consumers are buying, the cost per kilowatt hour on their electricity bill, which in many places, including California, gets you to cost effectiveness much more quickly. The other thing I haven't mentioned yet is that there are these solar incentives that bring that cost down. The costs that you mention are unsubsidized costs. But in the state of California, the government pays 40 to 50% of the cost of installing a system, and all of a sudden you can begin to see that the economics are pretty compelling for a home or business owner.
Okay, and at what point in the future will solar actually become right neck and neck with fossil fuels?
Well, I maintain that it already is, and what I mean by that is that the cost of generating solar on the home or business is already cost effective for a number of people who do the math correctly, who look at the appropriate methods of financing these systems, that there are many more applications where solar is cost effective than are currently being serviced. And the problem today isn't demand. The problem is supply. The industry is rapidly trying to deploy the capital to make these solar panels available, but demand continues to outpace their ability to meet it.
So, Mr. Bradford, the question is, what can we expect for the future of the economics of solar energy?
So, but what we'll begin to see now that we're in a situation where it's cost effective for a lot of users, and the volume of solar increases, it brings down the costs over because of scale and economies of scale and volumes and just getting better at it, which is what we've seen a lot in these electronics industries. And the costs continue to come down, and every time the cost comes down, more and more people find it cost effective. And this has created a positive feedback loop, the end of which will be a few decades from now, but the world and the energy infrastructure that we rely on will be radically transformed by that.
Okay, well, let's paint a picture as to what the future may look like. What will the home look like of the future? Are we talking about taking the state of Arizona and blanketing it with solar cells and then shooting the electricity out from Arizona? Are we talking about decentralized solar where people put solar panels on the rooftops? What is it going to look like?
Well, there will be, like a good economist, I'll have to say both. Energy will be generated in a lot of different ways in different places based on the resources and the resourcefulness of people in these locations. So utilities will decide that solar provides good daytime power, and they will create these larger centralized systems, and most likely in the sunniest places. There are large systems that are going up now in Arizona, Nevada, California, and that will continue to spread to other, less sunny places as the economics continue to improve. Also, homes and businesses will begin to adopt it, because now for the first time they have an alternative to the grid-based electricity monopoly that they've been purchasing their electricity from for many years. And what you'll end up with is a hybrid system, and this is very similar to what we have seen in recent technological transformations in telecommunications and computing, where we used to have these large centralized systems, and then because of the economics of semiconductors and being able to put power at the point of use, the systems migrated from large centralized systems to a hybrid distributed systems, where there was a lot more processing power at the point of use. And just because we all have PCs on our desk, it doesn't mean all the mainframes go away, but what you create is a much more robust infrastructure that's going to look very different than what people are used to today.
Okay. Now, what would it take to jumpstart this technology, given the fact that solar right now only yields a small fraction of the total energy that this country consumes? What would it take to jumpstart this technology? Mass production, tax credits, another oil jolt? What will it take to get the technology really up into the mainstream?
Well, I certainly think that all of the things that you mentioned would be good starts. We've already experienced this year, as I mentioned, federal tax credits, the first in 25 years to help make this more economic. We have seen a lot of interest because of the California incentive program. $3.35 billion is a lot of money going into building the industry in California, which will be available for other states. That expertise will be available in other states as they decide to promote solar further. And a lot of money has flown into the capital markets this year to expand the production of solar cells. And some federal money has also gone into additional research and development. So there's a lot of things that are moving in the right direction. The things that we need to do now are the two main things that I think are important. The first is we need to get national interconnection and net metering standards. What that means is that we need right now at every state and even in some cases local governments can dictate how and when a consumer can decide to put solar on their home or business. And we need to, and that makes it very hard for installers to create a standardized product because they have to meet different requirements in each of these jurisdictions. What we need is we need to give people the right to install solar when they want to and under some standard sets of technical parameters. That will certainly help the growth of solar. The second thing that we need to do is we need to recognize that every time we build a building that is not using the most efficient methods of energy use and insulation and, you know, energy efficiency standards, and we're building buildings that don't take into consideration the ability to generate electricity, we are wasting effort. We need to make sure that builders are thinking about on-site generation of solar energy in conjunction with all the energy efficiency technologies that are available when they're designing and building these buildings. And the California Solar Program alludes to this because it requires by 2012 that builders in California offer solar as an option on all new homes. And we need more of this. We need people to know that they can put this in at the time that they construct their building, which dramatically reduces the cost of installing it, allows you to finance it as part of the financing that you're already getting to pay for the building, and then not have to go back and retrofit it later in a way that might be suboptimal. So we need to start thinking a little bit better about how we're building buildings so that we stop making the problem of inefficient energy use worse.
And what about competition from other kinds of technologies, such as nuclear? How would you compare solar to nuclear?
The portfolio, there are lots of good options for energy, and different places are going to use different solutions to meeting their energy challenge. There are countries like Iceland that have lots of geothermal resources are going to use geothermal resources. They have more reliable geothermal than they have reliable sun, and that makes sense. Brazil is doing a lot with biofuels. They have a lot of farmland. They can produce biofuels relatively cheaply, and so they have become a world leader in that. Even within the United States, different regions have different resources. Some have more wind, and so that's going to be more economic for them. Some have lots of sun. The United States actually has, among industrialized nations, has a tremendous amount of sun per capita. So solar should be a big portion of the solution here in the United States. But the one thing to remember is the economic arguments that solar, by providing a distributed solution, is very different than large-scale nuclear, large-scale wind, large-scale geothermal, which, to be economic, all have to be generated in very big plants and then distributed through the transmission and distribution infrastructure. And solar is really the only technology, the only widely available technology that can sort of circumvent that transmission and distribution infrastructure and provide its power directly at the point of use. So it doesn't directly compete, at least on the distributed basis. It actually creates a new economic choice, a new competition, a new product for consumers to adopt. So regardless of what happens in the portfolio of energy choices that the utilities make, solar's opportunity is sort of outside of that portfolio mix, which is why it's not directly comparable.
And let's also talk about hydrogen. Hydrogen power is really not a way of generating electricity. It's nothing but a way of transmitting or transporting energy from one point to another. Some people say it's complementary to solar. A solar hydrogen economy is one alternative. But what are your thoughts about hydrogen and solar?
Well, I think your points are very good. Hydrogen does need an energy source to create it. And the problem, again, is hydrogen can be generated more economically today in centralized locations, but then you still have to get it to where the power is needed. We can't forget the cost of transporting power, and transporting hydrogen is a complex and expensive process. The problem with like a distributed solar architecture is that it needs some sort of on-site storage or some so that you have access to energy even when the sun's not shining. And the two ways that you can do that are through batteries or through making hydrogen out of the solar, and either through electrolysis or direct hydrogen generation. And there's a lot of promising technologies in that. So at the end of the day, it'll sort of depend on whether the economics of batteries or the economics of hydrogen improve faster, and the economics will depend not only on cost but the life of the systems and the reliability and a lot of other factors that go into making economic decisions. But at the end of the day, there's a back to tie this back to your question, your initial questions about oil. The only way that we're ever really going to solve the transportation fuel problem, we can partially solve the transportation fuel problems of oil through liquefaction, if we can do so in an environmentally responsible way. We can partially solve them through biofuels, but there are serious limits to those models, particularly when you start moving into places around the world that don't have as access to the capital and the farmland and the water and all the things that you need to go into those systems. The real way that we're going to solve the transportation fuel problem is to reattach the transportation infrastructure to the electric infrastructure. And today's hybrid vehicles and the emerging plug-in hybrid vehicles are the way to do that. You basically can use electricity to help power or ultimately power your transportation infrastructure. But these plug-in hybrids are going to have a lot of storage in them. They've got to have batteries or they've got to have hydrogen fuel cells to store the hydrogen energy. And by reattaching these solar sources of clean electricity to the energy storage available in hybrids and plug-in hybrids, you have a complete solution that I think is what will inevitably emerge as the paradigm for our energy future.
So just to elaborate a little bit about what the car of the future will look like, of course you cannot put uranium in your gas tanks, so nuclear is not going to solve the problem of transportation unless it generates electricity. But having solar panels on your car does not generate enough electricity to run the car. So what you're saying is the solution is a hybrid battery kind of technology then. Is that what you're saying?
Hybrid battery, cars are parked a lot of the day, and they're usually parked at homes or businesses, and that's where you'll be generating larger amounts of solar energy. The third generation of solar technologies, which will probably begin to emerge in the next 5 years, would actually allow you to paint the solar right into the paint of the car.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our first special guest has been Dr. Joseph Rahm, author of a disturbing new book called Hell and High Water. And the second guest was Travis Bradford, author of the book The Solar Revolution. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. Once again, that's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. And be sure to dial into my website. It's www.mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And so far, we average about 1 million page hits per month on that website. Good day.